And at this time, I would like to introduce our presenter, presenting for us today. We have Dr. Amy Kilbourn. She is the Director of Query for HSR&D, and we are very grateful to have her sharing her expertise with us today. So at this time, Amy, I'd like to turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks so much. And I'm really excited to be able to present, and I really appreciate the opportunity in doing so. So hopefully everyone can hear me. As Molly mentioned, the title of my talk today is on sequential multiple assignment randomized trials, otherwise known as SMART trials, and adaptive designs for implementation studies. So I'll be talking a little bit about that, and definitely want to thank my colleagues at Query and the University of Michigan for their guidance on using these types of study designs. So in the next slide, I wanted to just make the typical disclosures, and I just wanted to, just reiterate that the views I'm going to be talking about are mine, and the funding sources for what I'll be about to be presenting on come from both VA and NIH. So in the objectives in the next slide, I will be talking today on what are SMART and adaptive designs, and in addition to that, their application to implementation studies. And also, finally, I'll be talking about how to apply these designs to test different implementation strategies, which is a key priority goal of the Query Strategic Plan and most recently been incorporated into the VHA's new strategic plan called the Blueprint for Excellence. So in the next slide, I'm going to give you a brief definition of SMART trial designs and what they are. They are multi-stage trial designs where you essentially use the same subjects or participants throughout the study. So it's a closed cohort study involving randomization at different points. Each stage corresponds to a critical decision point. This is based on a pre-specified measure of responsiveness. That means that you essentially see how subjects or participants are responding to a certain treatment or intervention, and you make decisions about how they're going to get additional interventions based on whether or not they've responded to that initial intervention or not. The treatment or intervention options at randomization are restricted in SMART designs depending on a history of responsiveness. So you have very specific, essentially a very specific type of intervention you would randomize to, but it's also based on the history of whether or not that participant managed to hit a certain threshold of responsiveness. And then again, subjects or participants are randomized to a set of treatment options. So ultimately, a goal of a SMART design is to inform the development of an adaptive intervention strategy. And this is an important distinction. In a SMART design, you're really testing whether or not different interventions used at different critical decision points are actually working or not, because your hypotheses are going to be looking at, did the added or enhanced effect of a certain intervention that was given actually make a difference? Once you determine which of the types of interventions that you've either added or changed, then you kind of know the sequence of those additions or changes. Then you basically would be building what would be called an adaptive intervention. So if you think about it, a really good analogy is what's been often talked about in the in psychology and particularly in depression treatment and primary care, they often refer to something similar as stepped treatment, that you try an initial treatment on people with depression, and then if that doesn't work or if it only works in a very limited way, then you essentially step up the treatment in certain ways. So you may add a medication, then you may add psychotherapy, you may add some additional things. In the next slide, in SMART designs, I'm going to talk a little bit about the critical decisions and what they are. Usually in a SMART design, you usually have 2 to 3 critical decisions to address before you make a choice about randomization and what type of intervention. The first is around sequencing, which treatment to try first or intervention, which treatment to try if there's a sign of non-response, and which treatments to try if the particular subject or participant is doing well or not. And then there's also a question of timing. How soon do we declare non-response, and how soon do we declare response? And that actually may vary widely, and especially in health services intervention trials, you might be in a situation where you are working with practices as your participants, and some of those practices may, on their own, end up adopting a new type of model of care or something like that, but it just may take them longer, but they eventually adopt it. In addition, you also want to sort of think about which decisions are most controversial or need investigation. Oftentimes, these types of decisions may vary on the cost of the types of treatment or whether or not the treatment may have, you know, if it's a clinical treatment, people often try to weigh the benefits and costs of the side effects that may come up. In health services intervention trials, it may come down to cost and complexity of implementing the actual type of intervention. And then finally, you want to sort of make decisions on what, how to sequence interventions or treatments based on which will have the biggest impact on the outcome overall. So in the next slide is a diagram of a typical sequential multiple assignment randomization process. And essentially where it starts, where the actual smart design starts, is at the randomization point where you have an initial randomization of treatment A or B. And then as these lines, you'll basically see whether or not the treatment has early responders or non-responders. And at that point of the non-responders, then you essentially randomize individuals to either switching to a different treatment or augmenting with a different treatment. So this is sort of a typical way of actually designing these types of smart designs. And the best way to actually learn how to sort of do a smart design is to draw these figures out yourself and actually do the actual sequential paths and sort of look at how these pathways actually lead to a testing of a particular hypothesis. So, for example, in the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about how you design those. So, a smart trial and the CHIST principle. And what the CHIST principle means is keep it simple, stupid, for lack of a better term. The idea is you don't want to make the smart design too complicated. You want to basically have your primary outcome powered sufficiently for a simple, important primary hypothesis. That primary hypothesis may be based on only one type of treatment augmentation, and the others may be more exploratory hypotheses, so keep that in mind. At each stage, there is a critical decision point where you restrict a class of interventions based on essentially ethical or feasibility or strong scientific considerations. And again, this is where you really want to carefully choose what you would want to sequence in terms of different interventions. For implementation strategies, you want to define the response based on an outcome under provider control. So, for example, if you're trying to do a smart trial of different implementation strategies, and, for example, you might want to start initially with a toolkit, and then for sites that are not, you know, essentially using the toolkit to implement a certain evidence-based practice, you want to actually then maybe either augment the toolkit with additional training or just basically go and maybe switch the set of providers or practices to an intervention based on, let's say, quality improvement techniques like Lean. Now, in order to sort of make those decisions, you want to basically be able to monitor essentially a quote-unquote outcome that really tells you whether or not providers are using an evidence-based practice. So in many respects, you want to sort of find a validated measure. What you don't want to do is use a response measure that has nothing to do with your primary decision point, like whether or not, you know, essentially that downstream impact on patients. So you want to sort of pick something that is really a direct reflection of whether or not your intervention is actually making a difference in terms of using an evidence-based practice. In addition, you also want to collect intermediate outcomes that might be useful in ascertaining for whom each intervention works best to in order to inform an adaptive intervention. So these may be contextual factors. These could also be the factors influencing the types of patient populations different providers see if it's in health services or implementation trial. So in the next slide, I'm going to give a couple of examples of how to sort of design a SMART and a primary set of hypotheses. So for example, let's say you have a study that is going to be quite expensive and you have to be very sensitive to the number of subjects you enroll, whether it be you have to limit the number of sites you enroll if you're doing a clustered trial of a health services intervention implementation strategy, or if you're doing a patient-level trial of a new treatment and the type of treatment is for a specified type of patient population. You then want to hypothesize that initial treatment A or intervention A results in better outcome than initial treatment B. And so what that means is you're just basically hypothesizing, does A work better than B? And that's sort of your kind of typical primary hypothesis for a typical randomized controlled trial. if you have the opportunity to collect a larger sample, you know, given the, you know, resources and things like that, then you can sort of hypothesize the, what, you know, you kind of look at your diagram of smart trials or your smart design, and you can look downstream and hypothesize that a switch to a treatment C may result in better outcomes than an augmentation with treatment D. And in the next slide is the same diagram I presented earlier, but kind of outlines how you do that. So in the next slide, you'll see that there's an example where you see the red lines and then the blue lines. So, you know, a typical RCT would be powered to the first set of lines, which is, does treatment A work better than treatment B? Essentially, then if you have a much greater capacity to look at, you know, powering towards, you know, switch versus augmentation, then you would essentially power to the number of non-responders and look at whether or not the switch to treatment C is essentially better than augmentation with treatment D, or however you want to create your hypotheses. So the key is, you know, draw out what your smart design would look like and branch it out as far as you can and figure out what is really the burning question and power that to the, power your study based on that burning question. It may be the switch versus augmentation question, which means you may need a little bit more of a sample because you need to account for essentially a certain percentage of people who may respond right away to treatment A. The other thing, too, is you can also essentially do some really neat hypotheses around, you know, whether or not switching a treatment in general may be better than augmentation. So if you follow the red lines and, for example, look at among non-responders, those who switch to a treatment C are better or do better than those who switch to treatment D, or augment with treatment D, I should say, that could be another hypothesis, and that could, again, lead to some really interesting questions around, you know, regardless of what the initial treatment is, the, is switching better than augmentation? And that's also a very interesting question from a standpoint of health economics, because essentially switching may be more cost efficient than augmentation. So essentially you have these, when you see how the study branches out in these diagrams, you can see there could be some very nifty hypotheses coming out of it. In the next slide, in slide 10, there's a second example, and again, this is where we talk about essentially the example I just mentioned about, you know, whether or not switching versus augmentation makes a difference in outcomes. So again, you know, kind of as you diagram these smart trials out, that's where the thinking really comes out in terms of what you can really do with these types of studies. So now I'm going to talk about adaptive interventions. And adaptive interventions are slightly different, but are based on findings from a SMART trial. Adaptive intervention is a sequence of individually tailored decision rules that specify whether, how, and when to alter the intensity, type, dosage, or delivery of a treatment at a critical decision points in the medical care process. They operationalize the sequential decision-making with the aim of improving clinical practice. So they're often can be talked about as dynamic treatment regimens, adaptive treatment strategies. There are different words to actually use this, like stepped care is a sort of a clinical version of this. Another way of thinking about this is also a way of quantifying, but sometimes also generalizing what in implementation science many folks have actually done in terms of formative evaluation. So you do your initial implementation work, and then essentially you do your implementation intervention. You learn from that process what is working, what isn't working, and then you augment the implementation process in order to improve the uptake of an evidence-based practice. Imagine using an adaptive intervention to better essentially quantify what you've done and record what you've done so that at the end of the day you have more generalizable knowledge about your implementation strategy moving forward. So adaptive interventions are essentially ways of really codifying, in many respects, the work that goes into a formative evaluation. And this is an important piece where I think there's really a match made in heaven between smart designs and adaptive interventions in implementation science. This is a very interesting way, and I think a very cost-efficient way of doing implementation science work, because essentially you're using the study design itself to actually quantify and record what you're actually doing so that you can replicate it for future studies. So in the next slide, I'm giving you a third example of how you embed an adaptive intervention in a SMART study. So this is where you start answering questions about what would inform an adaptive intervention. So that what you would do is hypothesize that embedded adaptive treatment strategy 1, which would be in blue in the next slide, results in improved outcomes compared to an embedded adaptive treatment strategy 2 in red. And then the following slide, there's the example 3. You can see how you would calculate that. So your N would be, your N in each arm would be based on the number of people that are listed as following the blue arrows in low-level monitoring augmentation with treatment D versus the red arrows, which are focused on folks who got the relapse prevention or switched to treatment C. And this is, again, if you follow the blue and the red lines, essentially those are comparing two different types of adaptive interventions. It's basically taking the whole package on the upper arm and comparing it with the whole package in the lower arm. So in the next slide, I'm going to talk about why would you apply, again, the SMART designs to adaptive and adaptive interventions for implementation research. You know, why am I saying that this is a match made in heaven? It's a wonderful opportunity of a type of design. There are several reasons. One is, you know, you have heterogeneity like you would have in patients. You know, we're finding this out with precision medicine and the need to do more work in precision medicine. Well, there needs to be more precision at implementation. There's heterogeneity of practices and providers. Many of you doing implementation science work really know this already. You know, sometimes not all the barriers and facilitators that get recorded in organizational assessments are observable. Many of them are really subtle and are really hard to get in terms of an initial take, you know, unless you really want to sort of spend, you know, a lot of time inside the clinic, and it may take a while to get that information. Thirdly, the delivery of implementation strategies, you can deliver them when they're needed. This is really plays into the Rogers diffusion of innovation model. There are going to be some sites that are your sweetheart sites. They're gung-ho. They're going to want to implement your evidence-based practice. And then the others are just going to be a little bit slower in the uptake for various reasons. It's also a way of reacting to non-responsiveness and limited uptake sooner rather than later, instead of waiting for a year or 2 years to figure out, gee, we have this core group of sites that are not really doing much with their implementing evidence-based practice. And then also reduces the implementation burden, that you essentially use an implementation strategy using a SMART design only when it's necessary. This is what I often term as, you know, if you want to get from point A to point B, sometimes a Chevy will be enough, but other times you may need a Cadillac. And then finally, it helps you to sift through available implementation strategies. So implementation strategies are highly specified interventions used to help providers improve the uptake of evidence-based practices. And so you get some of the sites that are, I think, or providers at sites have who are having more difficulty implementing evidence-based practice, they'll get more attention over time, and this ultimately can lead to better chances of overall sustainability of the evidence-based practice. So in the next slide, I'm going to talk a little bit more about implementation strategies. So I mentioned the word a lot already, and so just to give you a specific definition and example, these are highly specified systematic processes used to help promote the use of treatments or practices, evidence-based practices, often at the clinic or provider level into usual care settings. And there are a plethora of types of implementation strategies, and recent work from the Aquarius Center is focused on documenting and classifying these types of strategies. But here are some key examples to highlight. They obviously don't represent all the implementation strategies, but some key ones that have been recently published. They include evidence-based quality improvement, which was used for primary care mental health integration in the TIDE study in the past. There was blended facilitation, which is based on the Paris framework, that was also used for primary care mental health integration. Getting to outcomes, which has been used a lot in community-based work and particularly for peer support in homelessness and other types of programs. And enhanced replicating effective programs, which was a model originally used by the CDC to rapidly implement evidence-based HIV prevention interventions into routine healthcare settings. So in the next slide, I'm going to sort of show you a descriptive picture of why it's important to do SMART trials and adaptive trials with implementation strategies. So these are, again, highly specified methods by which help providers or practices better adopt evidence-based treatments or practices. They vary widely in their cost, and they vary widely in the need at the site level and also the site commitment to actually implement them. So you can see in the bottom left corner, they're really sort of what I would call the toolkit types of implementation strategies. These tend to be sort of essentially top-down, very cursory. You roll them out. You can disseminate toolkits rather easily. If you add training to that, that's a little bit more costly, but you can probably do national webinar training of an evidence-based practice on how to use it. So at a relatively low cost, and probably for they may work for a certain proportion of sites that are probably going to be your early adopters. But there are other types of implementation strategies that require more one-on-one coaching, or what I would call a dialogue with frontline providers. And that also may require some in-person site visits to work with teams of providers. Those include facilitation, as well as lean types of quality improvement strategies. And then the most complex sites that really need both a combination of provider coaching and team building with process improvements in the, let's say, the information systems and also just with the entire clinic flow may require some much more intensive work around systems engineering. There's another dimension to many of these implementation strategies that I think may really have a lot of very interesting hypotheses in terms of studies to actually look at. Many of these may rely on what's been called as technical skills, or what has been called transactional leadership skills. These are skills that are mostly about, for example, education, teaching to the test, essentially, working with providers based on, have they accomplished a certain goal. Other types of implementation strategies get a lot more interpersonal, and they often focus on key areas of personal development of those frontline providers that in turn can help them, empower them to actually implement evidence-based practices. Those types of strategies may use a different dimension of adaptive learning skills, which, essentially could be situational awareness, leadership, sensitivity to different diverse groups of providers. And in leadership, that's often called transformational, because essentially the types of implementation strategies end up motivating or inspiring the frontline providers ultimately in terms of helping them to in turn motivate and inspire their clinic practices to adopt evidence-based practices. So there's really a sort of a dimension, sort of a third dimension there in terms of not only complexity, but sort of the type of training and expertise that's required for the implementation strategy experts to deliver. So that's sort of the current landscape from the standpoint of implementation science and where we are with implementation strategies. So, again, a lot of circles, a few hypotheses, and we've, great opportunities to study these further from the standpoint of implementation. So in the next slide, I'm going to walk through a couple studies. One was first, we went backwards where we first used enhanced rep as an implementation strategy and actually did an adaptive intervention. We then actually learned from that to essentially look at new types of implementation strategies to build a smart trial of implementation strategies. So this first example will be walking through what the enhanced rep program is. Now again, the enhanced rep implementation strategy was based on something that came from the Centers for Disease Control to help more rapidly translate behavioral interventions for HIV prevention into routine care. It has four stages, and enhanced rep is a version of rep that was enhanced to focus more on a stage of provider facilitation. So to give you an example, the way that enhanced rep was operationalized in this slide was there was pre-implementation work, which involved the identification of the need and program and the settings in which the evidence-based program was not being implemented at the time. There was also a stage in pre-implementation of essentially dialoguing with these practices to identify ways the evidence-based program could be adapted and written in a language that would be acceptable to frontline providers. That was called the packaging phase or stage, and essentially was based on input from a community working group of end users of a package of an evidence-based practice. In this situation, this was used for a self-management program for mood disorder. The rep implementation phase is involving four stages. One is disseminating a package, but also coupling that with provider training on how to use the intervention that was in the package. And then finally, the evaluation piece and monitoring response. Now, in this phase, at this time, if the dissemination of the package and training, there were still sites that were non-responsive to those, then the facilitation kicked in, and in this particular trial, we used external facilitation, which was delivered by a set of doctoral-level clinicians who basically called providers at sites that were non-responsive to the initial rep training and package, and basically did an assessment of barriers, why, you know, what were some of the reasons why it was difficult to implement the evidence-based practice, why the whether or not there were, you know, how to sort of problem solve around those barriers and coached providers on how to do that, and that was done via weekly calls. And then also just to promote success stories, you know, across different sites. And then the final stage of Enhanced Rep was the evaluation of long-term outcomes, you know, lessons learned for future diffusion and spread, and also looking at building a business case and a cost analysis of the implementation strategy. So on the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about the first study, which was the National Adaptive Implementation Strategy called Re-Engage. So Re-Engage used an enhanced rep as an implementation strategy. The aim of the Re-Engage study, which was a VA-funded study, was to determine among VA sites not initially responding to a standard implementation strategy, which was rep, the package and training, the effect of added facilitation or enhanced rep immediately versus delayed. This is the key here, that the timing of when you intervene based on non-response on the Re-Engage program uptake and patient use. This was a two-arm traditional cluster randomized controlled trial taking advantage of a natural experiment of a national program rollout. So this was based on a VHA national directive rolled out in early 2012 to implement the Re-Engage program across all mental health sites in the VA. And the rep was initially used to implement the program in 158 sites that were required to implement Re-Engage. 89 of those sites were non-responding, i.e. that they were essentially not, at that time, not really doing anything to implement the Re-Engaged program. And the Re-Engaged program was a brief care management program that actually had specific components of it that the providers had to do. And so 89 of the sites had essentially minimal uptake of the program, and those sites were randomized to receive added external facilitation or continuation of standard rep. Now, the next slide is the Re-Engaged study design. So to walk through this, at the time the study was started, all the sites got standard rep. And again, by 6 months, we gave them 6 months to respond. There were 89 sites that essentially did not respond, which was defined as basically the responding sites were defined as whether or not at least 80% of the patients who had dropped out of care were basically had their clinical status updated. What that meant was that were the providers going into CPRS and figuring out the clinical status of the patients who had dropped out of care. And the Re-Engaged study was all about providing brief care management to patients who had dropped out of care. And so after August 31st of 2012, the sites that had low uptake were then randomized to enhanced rep or standard rep. And then after 6 months, the enhanced rep ended for those sites that were randomized to enhanced rep. And then for the standard rep sites, then they got a delayed dose of enhanced rep in 6 months, which was considered phase two. And then follow-up was occurring another 6 months where we collected long-term outcomes at the patient level in terms of whether or not the Re-Engage program resulted in increased access to care, any sort of care, and whether or not the program itself was being used, and that includes measures of uptake as well. So in the next slide, I'll walk through what the Re-Engage program was and essentially how we define non-response again. So essentially each mental health program was supposed to hire a clinician called a local recovery coordinator. They're responsible for delivering recovery-oriented services or managing those services at that site for people with serious mental illness. These were recovery services often range from access to and support of employment to outpatient mental health treatment to self-management programs, depending on what the veteran needed. But these were the perfect individuals to implement an outreach program because essentially this program was designed to essentially reach out to veterans with serious mental illness who had dropped out of care and essentially not been seen by VA for at least a year. And if you have serious mental illness, you ought to be seen at least 3 months, in part because you have many times are taking medications that require monitoring, or you also might need outpatient mental health treatment. So what the local recovery coordinators, through this VA national directive, were supposed to do was to attempt to, they were each given a list of which veterans had not been seen or dropped out for at least a year. They were told to attempt to contact those veterans to assess their status and need for care. And for veterans who were successfully contacted, assess the clinical needs and schedule via appointments if the veteran desired to return to care. Then document efforts in a web-based registry. And non-response was defined as sites with less than 80% of patients with updated clinical status documented within 6 months of the list. So the idea was this was a measure that was based on what the providers could mostly control. It was really hard to control whether or not they could successfully reach a veteran, but what they could control was whether or not they could obtain and document updated information either through their electronic medical record or the internet about the disposition of that veteran, whether or not that veteran had not been seen because they're in a hospice or they are homeless, or whether or not that person just dropped out of care and might be at home and not receiving any care from the VA but still be eligible for VA care. All that information was recorded, as well as their risk profile in terms of what medications they were on and what medical conditions they may have, in order to determine severity up front so that this the local recovery coordinator can better triage care for this individual. So this type of care management, initial care management, was crucial to arm the local recovery coordinator with the information they needed to make sure that they routed that individual to appropriate care. So in the next slide, the implementation strategies are described in the next slide. So in this slide, we describe the standard rep, which again was the package and training. If there are questions about the re-engage program, there was brief technical assistance provided. Now, in the enhanced rep, they not only got the package and training, but they also were given essentially the coaching or the provider facilitation, the needs assessment, and that included, again, sort of what are the barriers from the provider's perspective, who the provider could rely on to help in terms of implementing the re-engage program, and also to come up with a specific problem-solving or action plan based on the experiences at other sites so that provider would have a strategy by which they can better implement. And oftentimes, some of the key barriers were the lack of ability to make appointments, and so essentially identifying a clerk to help make appointments for veterans. It also may have depended on the ability for that single provider to track down the number of veterans. Many of these providers may have had several people on their list who dropped out, so oftentimes they would elicit the help of the mental health peer specialist as an example. Another reason is, sort of how to get the patient or how to get the veteran back into primary care. These were mental health providers sitting in mental health care settings and with little contact with the primary care program didn't really know how to get that individual back into primary care. So essentially it was helping those providers, those local recovery coordinators, make connections to primary care to help them route a veteran into a needed, to get an appointment if needed. So in the next slide are the 12-month uptake results from the program. So in the green line is basically when the sites, after 6 months of non-response, that they were still not responding. The green line represents the uptake as measured by number of attempted contacts of the sites who got enhanced rep immediately. So these were sites in which providers had been called and by the facilitators. The facilitators were doctoral level clinicians with expertise in a re-engage program and also expertise in VA mental health care services. So these were the sites that had gotten the calls immediately on the coaching and facilitation. So after, as you can see from the line, after about 3 months, the percentage uptake started going up and was higher than the sites that had gotten no initial enhanced rep. But as you can see, after 6 months, the sites that were then given, that initially started without getting any enhanced rep, finally got enhanced rep, they quickly caught up in terms of responsiveness compared to the sites that got the immediate enhanced rep model. So in the next slide, we're going to talk about, what we learned from this experience in this 12-month adaptive intervention trial was, whether or not was external facilitation enough. And this is where we moved from sort of an initial adaptive intervention implementation towards another SMART trial to figure out, okay, what else is needed. So what we found was adding external facilitation in enhanced rep was not consistent across all the sites. So essentially the impact of it was not we weren't blowing out the sites, and essentially we weren't seeing a huge amount of uptake. We also looked at patient-level use, and we did not find much of an impact on the role of external facilitation on changes in patient-level use or access. So what we found, though, was that external facilitation seemed to help some sites but not all sites, and the actual, you know, time it took was, you know, after doing a calculation of the amount of time, we figured out that one, quote-unquote, dose of a six-month facilitation, which was provided by a doctoral-level clinician by phone on a weekly basis, costed us 7.3 hours per site. So this was a relatively low-cost implementation strategy, in part because it was done exclusively by phone and on a weekly basis, and we essentially had three part-time clinicians working as facilitators. And if you wanted to look at the carrying capacity, a full-time clinician as a facilitator probably could essentially provide external facilitation to two or three programs of similar capacity, such as re-engage or other brief care management programs. But what we also found out, and this is based on some of the work from the mental health query, is that some sites might need additional internal agents to address local barriers to treatment adoption. So on the one hand, having an external facilitator coach a frontline provider may have been helpful in terms of giving that provider some ideas for strategies on implementing the program, but they still needed some additional support, boots on the ground, to really help empower them to make sure that program was being used. So in the next slide, I'll talk about the SMART trial, the Adaptive Implementation of Effective Programs trial, or the ADEPT study. And this is a study that is ongoing right now. We don't have results for it, but it essentially was designed and it has been launched in this past year. The primary aim of ADEPT, and this is funded by NIH, is among sites not initially responding to REPs to implement a collaborative care program. This is a collaborative care program for mood disorders and community practices outside the VA. The sites receiving external and internal facilitator together versus sites only getting external facilitation alone will have improved 12-month patient outcomes and improved uptake of the program, which is measured as number of collaborative care visits. This was, for NIH purposes, this was designed and powered to achieve a primary outcome of whether or not this external internal facilitator role actually led to downstream effects in improved patient outcomes. So we powered the study for that primary outcome. The secondary aims were to look at the effect of continuing REP plus external facilitation versus adding internal facilitation, so looking at comparing the effectiveness. And then finally, continuing with whether or not REP combined external infill facilitation for a longer time period versus a shorter time period. So those were our embedded secondary aims. So in the next slide, I'll talk about the ADEPT design and where we are with it at this point. We are recruiting 60 community clinics, and also from each clinic, getting up to 1,200 patients total from all the clinics from the states of Michigan and Colorado. These are community clinics who are either primary care or mental health clinics. We're using a SMART design, and non-response is defined within 6 months, less than 50% of patients enrolled by a provider in a collaborative care program are actually enrolled in this program, and the enrolled patients are completing less than 75% of the collaborative care sessions that were recommended, which were up to 6 sessions. A reference for the actual stay design is available at the bottom of this slide. So in the next slide, I'll describe in more detail the implementation strategies used in ADEPT. So in this case, we are starting basically comparing the role of the external facilitator, which was very similar to the re-engage study, which was coaching and technical aspects of clinical treatment or intervention. The internal facilitator, which is added to the other arm, which is added to the external facilitator, is an identified non-on-site clinical manager who basically has to satisfy these criteria, has direct reporting line to leadership, some protected time, and who can help address unobservable organizational barriers and develop sustainability plans with leadership. This study actually provides an administrative supplement to the sites randomized to receive or to have the internal facilitator along with the external facilitator. That's what covers the protected time. So the next slide is the enhanced rep added facilitation based on the PAIRS framework. So again, this is how we've operationalized the enhanced rep implementation strategy. So you can see in the third box, you can see facilitation was broken up by external facilitation and internal facilitation. And then the next slide will have the adept design, and it basically is in phases. So in the study start, you have the run-in phase, in which all sites offered rep to implement evidence-based practices were essentially to implement the evidence-based practice, which was a collaborative care model. That involved all the sites. So we are recruiting up to 80 sites for starters. And then then we identify the non-responding sites, which we're about to do at this point. We have a few more months of follow-up. The non-responder definition is in that box. And then among the non-responding sites, at month 6, they are randomized to get either added external facilitation or combination of an internal and external facilitation. Again, randomized one-to-one, stratified by region, as well as whether or not it's primary care or mental health clinic. Now, in phase 2, we then follow up again. So at month 12, among the responders, we continue follow-up assessments. But for non-responders to REP EF, we then randomize them again to either have continued REP plus external facilitation, or then they get REP plus added external and internal facilitation as well. And as you can see from the other branch down here, you can see that we're doing something similar where the responders among the sites that got both the external and external facilitation in the first randomization, if they continue to non-respond, they will then end up continuing with the added combination of external and internal facilitation. And then essentially at the follow-up at months 18 and 24, we then continue follow-up assessments for all of them, but then we also continue with the REP plus external facilitation for those who were randomized to REP EF and then so forth. So you can see that there's essentially up to 5 boxes labeled A through E, and you can essentially do a combination and compare, actually box F as well, which includes the responders who initially responded at the beginning. You can see that you can do all sorts of combinations to sort of compare the effectiveness of the augmentation versus non-augmentation of adding external or internal facilitation. So in the next slide, I'll talk about the challenges and opportunities for doing these types of studies. You can see from the previous slide that, you know, it's hard enough to do a SMART trial with a patient population, even when you're trying to organize augmentation or switching of a medication or a type of psychotherapy or type of clinical intervention. When it comes to challenges and opportunities for doing these types of studies with implementation strategies, it can get really complicated really fast. And the first thing you'll need to have more than anything else is multiple sites. You'll need to have, you know, essentially, you know, probably back of the envelope at least 40 sites totals in order to randomize 20 sites to 20 sites. Some people need more. It really depends on what your outcome is that you're trying to achieve and what your previous effect size has been. You're also going to need valid and feasible non-response and outcome measures. To do this at a cost-efficient way, these non-response and outcome measures need to be collected or already routinely available. So it's oftentimes, you know, very difficult to do these types of studies without a regular source of outcomes data that can be essentially pulled from administrative data, chart review, and sometimes, as in the case of the re-engage study, we actually used a web-based survey to collect provider response. And so we actually used that as a way of basically measuring provider response and provider uptake of an evidence-based practice, and then essentially used that web-based survey to do that. And then we relied on patient-level administrative data to collect outcomes on patient-level utilization. But in many respects, that can be the most challenging aspect of comparing different implementation strategies in these types of designs. There's also the challenge of delayed effects and the timing of the response measure. So you really need to make sure you get data that can be measured in near real time. So if you try to measure something where there's a backlog or a delayed effect of getting the data, then it could be problematic because you may not know what's really happening within the past month. I think in terms of one of the advantages, though, of doing these SMART or adaptive trials is it's going to be important to learn how to catch a moving train. And this is, I think, going to be a very important piece of doing research in large healthcare systems like the VA and elsewhere, because the earlier you can convince leadership to basically build an adaptive or smart design into a national rollout of a policy, the better, because it certainly lowers the cost of doing these types of trials, and you certainly can also build in some preliminary baseline measures of outcomes and response in the beginning. When we did the re-engage study, we were able to convince national leadership to randomize sites, i.e. providers, in getting, you know, no external facilitation versus external facilitation. But the compromise was that they wanted all the providers to eventually get external facilitation. So essentially, we redesigned the randomizations so that we did a comparison of half the providers getting early external facilitation right away based on whether or not, you know, based on the earliest indication of non-response versus providers who waited 6 months before getting their dose of external facilitation. So it's an opportunity. And the way that we made that argument was that there was no way we can possibly give external facilitation across all the sites that needed it right away. The most equitable and just way of delivering external facilitation, which was a resource we were providing on a voluntary basis, pretty much through a grant, was to actually do a lottery, i.e. randomization. That was the argument that ultimately convinced the leadership to be allowing us to do the randomization. It is the idea that you want to be fair and you don't have all the resources to do everything at once. Why not build in a study to figure out if the resources, the added resources, you essentially are telling leadership that people will need to implement something are worth the time and money anyway. And I think finally, I think there's going to be a plethora, hopefully an increased plethora of implementation strategies that can be tested in smart type designs, you know, with these caveats in mind. Because I think in general, the VA and other places are looking for strategies beyond toolkits, but maybe not strategies that are going to be so cost heavy like, systems redesign, but there might be some strategies in between in terms of cost that may actually vary on their effectiveness based on the type of place and organizational context. So I think ultimately it's going to be very important to try to understand what are some of the implementation strategies that are really going to be the most effective in making practice change happen, and especially in making quality improvement happen with the uptake of evidence-based practices and so forth. So again, they made focus on transformational and intrinsic motivators of provider behavior change above and beyond the education piece, such as academic detailing and toolkits. So I think that is the end of the presentation. I wanted to just also provide my contact information and allow this opportunity to take any questions from the group. And I really appreciate the opportunity to present. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kilbourn. That was a very informative presentation, and we do have plenty of pending questions. For those of you that joined us after the top of the hour, to submit a question or comment, use the question section of the GoToWebinar dashboard on the right-hand side of your screen. Just click the plus sign next to the word questions. That will expand the dialog box where you can then type in your question or comment, and we'll get to it in the order that it is received. So we'll go ahead and jump right in. Give me just a second. I'm going to back up to the slide that this question is referencing. That's not quite the right one. Well, anyways, I'll get to it. So the question is, why is switching to treatment A if treatment B doesn't work, or to treatment B if treatment A doesn't work, why is that an option?
That's a good question. I think it could be an option where there might be certain treatments, especially in clinical science. You know, again, the SMART trials really grew out of the clinical science literature, that there might be something intrinsic about that treatment that works with that particular patient population or group of patients. But, again, we don't know what the reason is. We just have to keep testing different types of treatments.
Thank you very much. The next question, how do control groups fit into smart designs?
So control groups are definitely important. I think that they're usually at the provided at the beginning. I think that depending on what questions you're trying to answer, the control group may be the run-in phase at the beginning of a smart trial or an adaptive design, where you're essentially looking at a baseline impact of, you know, what is going on currently in the world in terms of an intervention or implementation. But I think in general for health services research, what is probably going to be increasingly happening is that it's going to be important to understand what usual care is and really what that defines. And so usual care outside the VA, for example, if you're looking at community primary care practices, will look a lot different than from inside the VA. So it's going to be important to understand and identify essentially what the control group will be, and that's especially important for health services because it really ties into what the definition of usual care is.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, are you using the CDW to assess quantitative outcomes for your studies? And you might want to spell that acronym out for any non-VA people on the call.
Sure. So the CDW is the VA's corporate data warehouse. And yes, the short answer is yes, we have used this corporate data warehouse to collect utilization information on patients. We've mainly focused on utilization and also pharmacotherapy because those were the most consistent ways in which we can get measures of utilization and access, which were our main outcomes for the re-engage trial.
Thank you for that reply. Next question, do these studies have to be run through co-op? I'm sorry, one second. Do these studies have to be run through co-op studies and central IRB given the large number of sites? What funding organizations and mechanisms have funded this research?
Sure. So if it's in the VA, it probably is typically easier to run it through a central IRB, but it gets complicated because it depends on the whether or not what is happening at the site level in terms of data collection. I'll give you the example of the re-engage study. We ended up not going through central IRB because essentially, even though we involved 89 sites, none of those sites were directly engaged in research. And the reason is this. We basically used virtual data collection from the frontline providers from each site using a web-based survey. We then also used the VA's corporate data warehouse to collect patient-level outcomes data. And basically, because we relied on those two main data sources, we were able to run it through the local IRBs and essentially make the argument that no other sites were engaged in research other than the sites that were doing the compilation of the data, which happened to be at the local site that we were working with. Now, for central IRB, it could be run there as well, but I think if you only have really one site where you have people boots on the ground and working with the VA data, then, and it's basically at one site, it can go through a local IRB, I believe.
Thank you. The next question, have you considered using adaptive randomization based on your Bayesian principles?
That's a really good question. I haven't thought through about how to incorporate Bayesian principles into the adaptive randomization, but there needs to be more research in this area. I would probably look at what has been done at the Institute for Social Research in this area, particularly work by at the University of Michigan's Institute for Social Research, particularly the work by Susan Murphy and Danny Almerl in that area.
Thank you. How do these types of studies fit with patient-centered care approaches and the idea that patients often choose an initial treatment option first?
I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about how to incorporate a SMART trial. I think one could maybe look at to what extent you can give patients more than one choice of a treatment, and then essentially if they agree to having more than one choice and maybe agree to randomization of more than one choice, you might be able to sort of build in a SMART design in that respect. But I think that there's a lot of ways in which that could be done. You have to sort of, you know, if you do build in patient choice, you have to look at the selection effects of that choice, though.
Thank you. The next question, can you please provide some references on the transactional versus adaptive transformational implementation strategies?
Sure. I think the best resource to really understand the definitions of transactional and transformational really come from work that's been done on leadership interventions by Bruce Avolio, A-V-O-L-I-O, I believe, who's at the University of Washington. A person who's worked a lot with those theories on transactional and transformational leadership has been the work by Gregory Ahrens at UC San Diego, and so has looked at ways of measuring types of leadership and is built into the transformational transactional leadership characteristics, I believe, into implementation strategies that have primarily focused on leadership skill building.
Thank you. How do you maintain statistical power in a smart design where at the end of the study you have multiple distinct treatment groups? Are special statistical techniques necessary?
I think so. You can use some techniques, but I think the important thing is to make sure you, at the first point of randomization, you have more than enough individuals or sites to randomize so that you have sufficient power to compare the outcomes that you're most interested in. So it's a smart trial. One of the things about smart trial is, you know, you can the sky's the limit in terms of how many hypotheses you can test. The issue is, though, you're limited in power. So you really want to choose what your most important hypothesis is. If it's switch versus augmentation, that can give you a little bit more power because you'll have more sites or individuals. But if it's just comparing, sort of an augmentation of treatment A versus B in a subset of individuals who didn't respond, then that would require, you know, careful consideration of the minimum amount of people. So there are two things. You would want to essentially build in an estimate of how many people will respond and subtract those from the original sample size. And then after that, you also want to, you know, if you are looking at, you know, conducting a smart trial of implementation strategies, your unit of randomization will be at the sites. The important thing is to build in the real effect size based on the cluster coefficient of sites per patient, especially if your primary outcome is going to be on, let's say, for example, patient-level utilization. So those two things to consider, again, are, you know, essentially assuming, you know, there will be sites or people that drop out because they've responded, you want to make sure you have enough non-responders to randomize to look at the main outcome. And then, again, if you're doing a clustered randomization, you want to make sure that you calculate the effect size based on the cluster coefficient of the number of patients per site.
Thank you. We do have just three pending questions. The next one, and you may have answered this in the last CDW question, is this use of CDW included as part of the IRB approval?
The actual way that we designed the IRB approval was any of the activities around actually it was funny because the way it got split out was really interesting because in the VA, if a program office agrees to randomize and a program office agrees to the intervention, they can write a letter saying that the randomization piece, even at the site level and sometimes at the patient level, and the use of facilitation constitutes what they consider quality improvement. That piece actually was considered the quality improvement piece or non-research. Our data collection from we did some organizational assessments and then the CDW or corporate data house warehouse pull, that piece was considered research. And that's why we were able to sort of piggyback on top of a quality improvement initiative, a small research component, which was the data collection from the corporate data warehouse. But that distinction was made because it was ultimately the program office that made the decision to randomize and to allow us to use facilitation. So that was considered the quality improvement. And to get more information on distinguishing quality improvement from research, VHA has a wonderful handbook. It's 1058.05, that basically describes how you go about distinguishing operations / QI from research and how do you actually go about getting approval to do this type of work as quality improvement. And it does involve a letter from a program office. But at the same time, you just basically very specifically carve out what exactly you're collecting in terms of data or using in terms of data to basically inform generalizable knowledge. And we narrowed that focus area to the collection of the corporate data warehouse as well as the provider surveys.
Thank you. The next question, for the ADEPT study, what happens to a site that is initially a responder at a study start, but then for some reason are unable to sustain the intervention and become a non-responder at some point in phase two?
So what we have done is we essentially have defined responsiveness based on a relatively brief window. So to not make this study too complicated, we will monitor over time if they slip out and become non-responders. But the way that we defined response was essentially, did they offer the care management strategy to up to 20 patients, and then did they offer all the components? And the care management strategy itself is relatively brief in the scheme of things, that it actually lasts for only a little bit less than 6 months. So once they're done with providing a care management program to the 20 patients, then they essentially are, those individuals are still followed, but we would basically, you know, not really include them back into the randomization, because our expectation for them to do the intervention was relatively short to begin with.
Thank you for that reply. The next question, can natural temporal variation in the adoption of certain interventions serve as an observational SMART paradigm? In other words, can we perform multiple pre-post observations?
So, yeah, so if you can do that and you have the granularity of the data, that would be really interesting. I think that it would depend on how the naturalistic variation happens, and probably it could be done to maybe observe, you know, what is being done in the real world before you actually design a SMART trial. So it would be a very interesting design from the perspective of maybe coming to some conclusions about what might work best. And sometimes, you know, we'll see in situations where sites or individuals just adapt and change to essentially better accommodate or better improve care anyway, and that's going to be very interesting preliminary work to do in order to build a trial. A SMART trial would be used only when there are specific unanswered questions about which type of intervention works best and in what circumstances. So it would be good to get naturalistic studies to inform a SMART trial in that way.
Thank you. We have reached the top of the hour, so if any of our attendees need to leave the session, I do highly encourage you as you exit the session to wait just a second while our feedback survey pops up on your screen. We do look carefully at the feedback to improve the previous sessions as well as decide which sessions to support, so please take just a moment to answer those 5 or 6 questions. And in the meantime, Dr. Kilbourn, I'd like to give you the opportunity to make any concluding comments you have.
No, at this point, I just want to thank the folks in the Cyber Seminar Series for the opportunity to speak and present. And I also want to, on behalf of Quarry, just thank the Quarry Centers who really informed a lot of this science, and also the University of Michigan Institute for Social Research.
Well, excellent. Well, thank you very much for lending your expertise to the field. It was a great presentation, and of course, thank you to our attendees for joining us. We have recorded today's presentation, and you will receive a follow-up email 2 days from now with a link leading directly to this recording and the handouts. Feel free to pass that along to any colleagues you feel are interested in this topic, and please join us for our next Quarry Cyber Seminar, which they always take place on the first Thursday of the month at noon Eastern, so please look in our online catalog to register for that. So thank you once again, everyone, and this does conclude today's HSR&D Cyber Seminar.